This is 2RPH. I'm Jolyon Warwick-James, and you're listening to the Antiques Radio Show, bringing you a monthly kaleidoscope of things old, beautiful, or both, whether valuable or not. Hello. Today we are bringing you the usual crop of curious, commonplace and collectible objects, comprising cricket, cabin baggage and corkscrews, and the prices they fetched. We feature the trials, tribulations and triumphs of museums, some stories of how these institutions have fascinated, educated and sometimes even offended, at least some people. But who? Weaved into all this is a suggestion for a good visit, a book to read, and some jaw-dropping name-dropping of a very famous artist. Stay tuned. And the first over to be bowled comes from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 2nd of February 2019. Painting shows some of the earliest days at the crease. An English school painting depicting one of the earliest venues in cricket was knocked down at £14,000 in a Winchester auction. That's around $25,000 Australian dollars. The 19 inch by 2 foot 3 inches, that's 49.5 by 69 centimetres oil on canvas, showed a cricket match being played at White Conduit Fields in Islington, one of the earliest recorded venues for the game, and the original home of the White Conduit Club, which later became the Marylebone Cricket Club. Cricket was played at this site until 1786, when Thomas Lord founded an alternative venue, now known as Lord's Old Ground. It was a further 3 decades before he opened the present Lord's Cricket Ground, formerly a duck pond in St John's Wood, in 1814. The painting, catalogued as the Vendors family for at least 3 generations, was offered at Andrew Smith & Sons, with a 21% buyer's premium, on December the 11th, with an estimate of £4,000 to £6,000. It shows batsmen playing with curved bats, underarm bowling, and 3 stumps, the latter introduced to the sport in 1775. As later copies dating to the 20th century are known to exist, the auctioneer decided against publishing a specific date in the catalogue, although they believed it most probably late 18th or early 19th century. A sale room amendment for the lot read it was being offered without a date of artistry. Catherine Hockley, director of Andrew Smith & Sons, said, "We had a fair amount of interest from cricket buffs, and it sold to a collector on the phone who had viewed it. The picture had condition issues, including areas of restoration, overpainting, surface craquelure and discoloration." And that came from the Antique Trade Gazette on the 2nd of February. And, well, how's that? And moving along to travel goods. What would you pay for some travel luggage? Well, we're going to stay with the Antique Trade Gazette of the 29th of December 2018. And this actually was Pick of the Week. Travel trunk full of interest. "Every specialist has an object that they dream of having in their sales," says Matthew Rubinger, Christie's head of handbags and accessories. "For me, it's the aluminium Explorer trunk by Louis Vuitton. The market is full of silver-coloured metal trunks, but this piece is the inspiration." Louis Vuitton produced just a handful of these 2'6", that's 75 centimetre, aluminium trunks in a single year, 1892. Today, only 2 examples are known to exist. One resides in the Louis Vuitton Foundation in Paris. The other, described in the catalogue as extremely rare and exorbitantly special, was offered at Christie's on December the 12th with an estimate of £50,000 to £100,000. The Explorer, with a flat top that could be stacked, was produced for tropical climes in zinc, copper and brass throughout the 1890s, but aluminium models were by far the most luxurious. At the time, the now common material was considered precious metal. It was not until 1905 that Georges Vuitton received a patent for perfecting the use of aluminium for travel items. No record exists of who originally owned this trunk. Initials painted on the side are impossible to decipher. Dents and scratches suggest it may have seen the world, but it spent much of its life stowed in a UK basement kept by a family who were unaware of its historical importance or commercial value. Pitched at a level way above that even a typical LV trunk might bring, it generated spirited competition between three phones, a battle that only ended at £130,000 plus 25% premium. That in Australian dollars is approximately $300,000. Thank you, Roland Arkell of the Antiques Trade Gazette. That does make your holiday a little bit more expensive, doesn't it? Here's a question for you. What might appeal to a gun collector and a corkscrew collector? How about a horizontal device which screws to a table or sideboard with a crank handle at one end? And this comes from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 12th of January 2019. From cartridge loader to corkscrew. One of the most unusual corkscrews to come onto what is a fiercely competitive collector's market recently was a brass, steel and wooden contraption of the type one might have seen clamped to the bar of a fin de siècle brasserie. Offered at Malham's with a 20% buyer's premium, Abingdon Rooms on December the 3rd, it was stamped with the French patent mark Brevete SGDG and the maker's initials MD. Michael Durafort, a Saint-Étienne manufacturer who worked from 1890 to 1902, was plainly an inventive recycler. The corkscrew was originally a rifle cartridge loader, which had been converted into this device with a wooden handle and a thumb-screw twist grip. Rare enough to be extremely difficult to catalogue, it was given a speculative £50 to £80 estimate. Wide competition came down to two determined bidders, an online continental bidder and a London dealer. Victory went to London via the phone at £8,000, and that's around $14,500. And that came from the Antique Trade Gazette on the 12th of January. Now that's a fairly expensive way to open a bottle, but what about the bottle itself? What can they cost? What do you think the world record price for a bottle of wine is? Now, this comes from our list of auction records from www.news.artnet.com on the 13th of November 2018. There was a list of world records, and here's the world record for a bottle of wine. And what was the bottle of wine? It was a Romanée Conti 1945. And the price? $558,000. That's approximately $780,000 Australian. October 2018. Where? Sotheby's, New York. Why? During a single wine auction this past fall, Sotheby's twice broke the record for the most expensive bottle of wine ever sold, when two rare bottles of 1945 Romanée Conti were offered from the personal cellar of connoisseur Robert Drouin, patriarch of the family-run Maison Joseph Drouin. One bottle sold for $558,000, while a second went for $496,000, far exceeding the previous record of $310,700 set in 2007. Not surprisingly, the entire sale of Drouin cellars from Beaune, France, was 100% sold in a white glove sale that totaled $7.3 million, more than five times its estimate. And that came from news.artnet.com, November the 13th, 2018. Could make a very expensive dinner party, but rather fun if you can afford it. You're listening to the Antiques Radio Show with Jolly and Warwick James on the RPH Network. And let's now move on to museums. Those wonderful institutions which do so much for us in society, but sometimes they can run into a few problems. And here is just one such problem, which comes from TheGuardian.com, that's the English newspaper, written by Martin Bellum on Wednesday the 13th of September 2017. Heading, British Museum says too many Asian names on labels can be confusing. Museum apologises for any offence caused after criticism on Twitter over curators' comments about exhibition labels. And this comes with a picture of the British Museum, photograph, John Walton, PA. And it runs, the article runs like this. A curator from the British Museum has claimed they have to be careful about using too many Asian names on exhibit labels, as they can be confusing to teenagers. The museum was taking part in a hashtag Ask a Curator on Twitter, in which staff at museums around the world answer questions. Responding to a tweet from the Museum of Applied Arts and Sciences in Sydney, that was formerly the Powerhouse, asking, how do you go about designing exhibition labels and information that are accessible to a wider range of people? The British Museum's official account answered, curators write the labels based on their specialist knowledge and they're edited by our interpretation department. We aim to be understandable by 16-year-olds. Sometimes Asian names can be confusing, so we have to be careful about using too many. The British Museum tweets referring to Asian names, photograph Twitter/British Museum. The tweets, which appear to have been written by the keeper of the Asia department, led to an angry response from other Twitter users. Here's some examples of them. This is a gigantic own goal. I strongly suggest you revise your approach here. And another. What are you saying to those of us, and especially the kids, with Asian names doing this? Think long and hard about this. And yet another. Jesus, confusing to whom? Your white patrons, haven't you stolen enough history? And finally, longer labels, technologies such as touchscreens, audio recordings, so many ways around this. Don't blame the 16-year-olds. And on the September the 13th, the museum attempted to clarify the comments, saying, we're limited by the length of labels. Dynasties and gods have different names in various Asian languages. We want to focus on the stories. It gave the examples that the Buddhist Bodhisattva of mercy is known as Avalokiteshvara in India, Guan Yin in China, Kuan Yin in Korea, and Kanon in Japan. This was not seen as a satisfactory answer by some. And here are some more responses. No, this is the story. It's fascinating that the same thing is known by so many different names. And another one. This seems a perfectly sensible approach. The BM acts as a starting point to learn about other cultures. And the museum responded, we would like to apologise for any offence caused. Jane was answering a very specific question about how we make the information on object labels accessible to a wider range of people. Label text for any object is necessarily limited, and we try to tell the object story as well as include essential information about what it is and where it is from. We're not always able to reflect the complexity of the different names for, e.g. periods, rulers, gods in different languages, and cultures on labels. This is explored in more depth through our public programme, audio guides, tours, lectures, exhibitions, research projects, and school sessions, etc. And that came from TheGuardian.com. I think I'd call that a storm in a showcase. And we stay with museums, but and now for something completely different. And this comes from the art newspaper, February 2019. Monty Python snub pretentious V&A. Eric Idle, one of the founding members of the British comedy troupe Monty Python, revealed in his memoir, Always Look on the Bright Side of Life, that the group pulled out of a recently planned exhibition at the Victoria and Albert Museum, that's the V&A, in London, after clashing with the institution over the show's proposed title. Idle and his fellow Python comedians, John Cleese, Terry Gilliam, Michael Palin and Terry Jones, wanted to call the exhibition Monty Python the Same Old Bollocks, but V&A curators preferred Monty Python from Dali to Dead Parrots, which the group hated. It became clear they were doing an exhibition on surrealism, writes Idle in his book. The pretentious nonsense. We're nothing to do with Dali or Duchamp. Python has always been about comedy. That is the art. He adds, I was never producer of Python, then when we all said no, the museum couldn't believe it. And that was from the Art newspaper, February 2019. And now for a slightly happier museum story. Here's a very interesting exhibition at the Australian Museum. I've just been to see it and it's really rather good. The museum is situated on the edge of the city near Hyde Park. Official address is 1 William Street. And the exhibition is called Capturing Nature. And I'm reading from the press release. New exhibition reveals Australia's earliest scientific photography, Capturing Nature. Early photography at the Australian Museum, 1857 to 1893. Taken from the Australian Museum's extensive archival collection of glass plate negatives, 67 large format photographic prints showcase the scientific discoveries of Australian Museum scientists between the 1850s and 1890s, while also telling the story of the advent of photography in the young colony, less than 10 years after the birth of photography in Europe. The images range from the initial tentative experiments in the 1850s to the time when photography was becoming an indispensable part of museum practice in the early 1890s. The subjects vary from a large sunfish and the flipper of a sperm whale to a gorilla and the fragile bones of a flamingo. Most of the specimens photographed at the museum are by taxidermist Henry Barnes and his son Henry Barnes Jr., with the help of the AM's pioneering curator Gerard Kreft. Visitors to the exhibition will see some of the original taxidermied specimens and period cameras alongside 67 rich, large-format prints. Collectively, they highlight the legacy of this photographic medium, demonstrating the importance of glass plate photography as a viable and popular art, as well as a recorder of history and science. Australian Museum Director and CEO Kim McKay, AO, said some of the earliest adopters of photography were scientists. They were quick to see its enormous potential for capturing the process of discovery and describing new species which are the foundation of scientific practice, she said. In the Victorian era, museums were the public face of science. At the Australian Museum, the arrival of curator and scientist Gerard Kreft in 1864 marked a fortuitous coming together of skills, experience and technology. The images by Gerard Kreft and his taxidermist Henry Barnes not only produced records for the museum, but also helped them share the museum's work around the world. Their early images showcase the creativity, innovation, and experimentation that were and remain part of the Australian Museum's DNA, McKay added. At a time before photography scientists relied on illustrators or their drawings to depict their discoveries and research work. The illustrations took time, patience and meticulous skill. But with the advent of photography, the documentation of natural history now provided important evidence of the finds while also contributing to the standing of the Australian Museum scientists at home and abroad. The early glass plates are called V negatives, with the oldest dating back to as early as the 1850s, making them some of the earliest scientific photographs taken in Australia. The new technology captured light on glass and provided for the first time an unmediated mechanical representation of nature and the world. Curators of the exhibition and author of the accompanying book, AM's archivist and manager of rare books, Vanessa Finney, said the AM has over 15,000 glass plate negatives in its photographic archives. The photographs document the rapid expansion of the museum's specimen collection in the 19th century. They're a museum rogues gallery, dozens of animals captured mugshot style against a white sheet backdrop, Finney said. The photography was expensive and complicated, so every photograph was carefully planned. The animals were first prepared and posed and then positioned for best natural light and least shadow. The photos were taken in and around the museum, mostly in the courtyards and gardens, to best exploit the precious light required by the photographer's rudimentary cameras. Alongside the specimens, the figures of scientists can often be seen as a gauge of scale. In these days of instant digital images, it's hard to imagine the effort that went into creating photos during photography's first century and a half. Each single image was precious and painstaking to create, Finney said. Finney explained, through their photography, Kreft and Barnes were spreading the knowledge of Australian science. Their photographs disseminated to the world the image of Australia and its fauna at a time of great international enthusiasm for the fledgling colonies, unusual plants and animals. Beautiful and haunting, sometimes strange, capturing nature is not only a unique record of early Australian science, but also brings to life the story of one of humankind's great inventories. And this goes with a book, and the book is entitled Capturing Nature, Early Scientific Photography at the Australian Museum, 1857 to 1893. Author Vanessa Finney, RRP, that's recommended retail price, $49.99, a little bit more in New Zealand. It is available at the Australian Museum store and at all good bookstores. The exhibition runs until the 21st of July 2019. And that was the press release from the Australian Museum in Sydney, just by Hyde Park at 1 William Street, Capturing Nature. And it's well worth a visit. And now for a little bit of trivia. And this comes from news.artnet.com on the 25th of January. Hilarious and surprising things named after famous artists. Exactly. Can you guess what's coming? Rembrandt toothpaste. And it comes with a picture of the packaging of a tube of toothpaste with Rembrandt written across it. And the article reads, named after Rembrandt van Rijn, 1606 to 1669, Dutch old master painter. The story? Owned by Johnson & Johnson, this is a line of toothpastes that pioneered the tooth whitening category. How appropriate to the artist's legacy? When you think of Rembrandt, you think of rich browns, golds and tans, and intricate modulations of smoky black. You think of chiaroscuro, so much so that the studio photographers used Rembrandt's lighting to get the drama of his portraits where faces were half covered in shadow. You think of The Night Watch, a painting most famous for pulling off the painterly feat of centering its focus on a huge black mass. You think of an atmosphere of pride and regret. You think of soul-bearing self-portraits staring unflinchingly at the toll of time. You do not think of white teeth. And the writer of that gave it 1 out of 10. And that was from news.artnet.com on the 25th of January. It's tempting to think that somebody is trying to cash in on the 350th anniversary of Rembrandt's death. Anyway, hopefully it'll make your smile a little bit whiter. And finally, a piece, or another piece, from our auction records, www.news.artnet.com, November the 13th. What do you think the most expensive Barbie doll ever was? Any idea of the price? Well, this piece comes with a picture of a Barbie doll, with the backdrop being the Opera House, probably just about as expensive as the Barbie doll. And it's entitled Barbie Doll Stefani Canturi Barbie. Price $302,000 US. That's approximately $425,000 Australian. When? October 2010. Where? Christie's New York. Why? The 11.5-inch tall custom doll was designed by the Australian jeweller Stefano Canturi and wears a strapless black dress with a 1-carat pink diamond necklace surrounded by 3 carats of white diamonds. The proceeds for the auction went to benefit breast cancer research. And I think she'd make an excellent partner to go to the Opera House with. And now, finally, and this comes from news.artnet.com, and it was on the 18th of February. It's something I don't know whether you can conceive of. It's entitled, "An Antiques Dealer Thinks He's Found the Bed Where King Henry VIII Was Conceived. It Was Hiding in Plain Sight in an English Hotel Room." And it comes with a picture of this four-poster contraption. An intricately carved and decorated oak four-poster bed that spent more than 15 years furnishing the honeymoon suite of a British hotel may have belonged to King Henry VII and Elizabeth of York, the founders of the House of Tudor, and it may be where their infamous son, Henry VIII, was conceived. The bed was saved from a scrap heap in 2010 by an antiques dealer who consigned it to a Chester-based auction house where it was listed as a profusely carved Victorian four-poster bed with armorial shields, according to Smithsonian magazine. But Ian Coulson, who bought the piece for £2,200, recognised that the bed showed signs of extensive restoration, which would have been unusual for such a recent piece of furniture. He also noticed that the markings on the frame suggested it was hand-carved and not manufactured with a mechanised saw. Coulson then spent the next 9 years researching the bed, which is rich in Tudor iconography and includes depictions of red and white roses which stood respectively for the houses of Lancaster and York. The houses were united through the marriage of Henry and Elizabeth. The fact that the roses are depicted separately and not as the unified Tudor rose may be because the unified iconography of the new house had not yet been developed. Fertility symbols such as depictions of Adam and Eve in the headboard's central panel support the likelihood that the bed was made shortly after the couple's union, when there was an urgent need to secure the house's dynasty through the birth of a male heir. Further forensic evidence has revealed traces of ultramarine paint, an expensive pigment more costly than gold in the 15th century England, which means the bed was likely to have belonged to someone of enormous means. Coulson presented his findings in January to a symposium at the Victorian Albert Museum. His presentation was first reported by Live Science. Thank you, news.artnet.com. That's all we have time for today on the Antiques Radio Show. If you have any feedback or issues you'd like to raise, please telephone 9518 8811 or email info@2rph.org.au. I'm Jolyon Warwick-James and I work in the antiques industry. I have developed this program as a volunteer, unrelated to my business.